What do you want most out of life? If we had put this question to Mordecai, the ancestral hero of our Purim story, his answer would have been immediate and succinct. Life itself. For those who live with a foeman's steel pressed against their jugular, the range of need narrows remarkably. And that is in its own way why often the Megillah, the story of Purim, seems strange and foreign to us. It was written by those who knew the edge of desperation. It has been appreciated by those who have known that bitterness. We are strange creatures, you and I. Our lives have paralleled the barbarism of a Haman whose skill at evil reduces to rank amateurism the Haman of the Bible. And yet such is the shortness of our memory that we feel ourselves at ease in Zion. We are a casual generation. Oh, yes. We talk about atomic war, and we make some brave words about the possibility of being reduced to nuclear ash. But it's all a brave pose. We don't really believe it. We're a prosperous generation. We're a positive thinking generation. We're a generation which enjoys more opportunity, a greater range of expectancy than any known heretofore to man. We can bring into our homes for an evening the beauty, the depth, the precision of the great symphonies of the world. We can take down from our shelves books which reproduce for us in full color the art masterworks of civilization. Books were once chained to desks. So rare and so precious were they. Today, in exchange for a few minutes of work, we can purchase the delicacies of literature and the adventures of the greatest of our intellects. No generation in all history has been as blessed as we are. We ought to know the joy of living. Our philosophy ought to refract it. Why then the lines in our face? Why our ulcers? Why our heart attack? Why can't we stop smoking? Why every night do we have to gobble down pill after pill, tranquilizer and sleeping potion? Why, for all of our blessing, are we an anxious age? The aspirin age? Why don't we know the art of happiness? How shall we begin to find it? Perhaps we had better put to ourselves the question that we put to Mordecai. What do we want most in life? I suspect the vast majority of us would say we want happiness. But happiness is a vague, abstract term. What do we mean by it? Most of us have something fairly definite in mind. For some of us, happiness is money. A sufficiently substantial bank account that we no longer fear slipping back into the poverty from which we began. For others among us, happiness is fame. Our name in the newspaper. The assurance that we are not just another anonymous integer who lives and breathes and dies along with tens and thousands of other meaningless people. For some of us, happiness is harmony in our homes, proficiency in a profession, retirement, scholarship at a university, a possession. Most of us associate happiness with the acquiring of something or the attaining of some goal. And the tragedy of our life is simply this, that the goal attained, the thing purchased, we are as unhappy and as uncertain and as anxious as ever before. The cruelty of human nature is that the list of the things we want seems to be endless. We seem never to be able to say, Dayeni. It is enough for me. I am happy. The famished man wants only a morsel of bread. The gourmet turns up his nose in disgust if the salad presented to him has too much of a taint of vinegar. We seem to lack the ability to be moderate in our judgments, to be satisfied. All of us are guilty of the confusion that happiness is a beachhead, which can be gained, conquered by some frontal attack. It cannot. So we press on, and we reach out, and we seek to draw in. And yesterday's luxury becomes today's necessary. And yesterday's indulgence becomes today's urgency. The list, the catalog of our needs is endless. One achieved, another appears on the horizon. There is more truth than we care to admit to the child's refrain. He spent his health to get his wealth. And then with might and main, he turned around and spent his wealth to get his health again. You laugh. But each of us can provide the identity of the anonymous he, and sometimes of the she who drove him to it. And sometimes that he and that she is sitting right in our pew. Let's be honest with ourselves. We're a greedy, grasping lot. Ours is an acquisitive, a voracious generation. We have been taken in by our own advertising, that expensive advertising, to believe that somehow we can purchase happiness with a bar of soap, a new car, a certain home and a certain address in a certain suburb. And we are never satisfied. We keep buying. We keep wanting more. We have such voracious appetites that for all of our affluence, we are the most money-harried, debt-ridden generation in all of history. Such is the voraciousness of our appetites that we are never satisfied. We want more. We engorge ourselves. We are never, never at peace. Now let's make a second confession. Such is the materialism, the greed of this generation, that we do judge people by their wealth and by their position rather than by their worth and their principles. Good people do live in big homes. We do want our children to associate with the children of parents who live in the right suburbs. We take pride in the label, the affluent society. Indeed, we insist that society be affluent. And if a man has by suspicious practice made a sufficient fortune, his obituary will surely include the phrase, he was an unusually ingenious businessman. Let's make confession. Goods have their place. The miracles of production can add to the goodness and to the opportunity of life. But our taste knows no bounds. It is immoderate. We have forgotten the truth of that beautiful rabbinic parable about the flute, the simple reed flute that hung in the temple in Jerusalem. Why did it hang there? Tradition had it that this flute had been carved by Moses himself when he was tending the sheep of Jethro the Midianite in the wilderness of Sinai. It was a beautiful instrument. Its tone was preternaturally clear. And so revered was it that one day the priests of the sanctuary determined to gild it. And they hired the finest silversmith of the land. And he practiced the rarest of his art upon it. And they returned this flute to the sanctuary. And they played it. And its clear, cool tone was now somehow hollow, metallic. The gold had coarsened it. Greed coarsens our lives and it shortens our lives. Immoderate ambition coarsens our lives and abbreviates them. We are moonstruck. We reach out, not for useful ambition only, but for goals that no man need attain. And like Icarus of the ancient Greek myth, we fly too high, and our wings become wax, and we fall headlong, heads over heels, to the earth. The cruelty of our human nature is that we do not seem to be able to satisfy, to satiate our natural appetites, our cravings. We want always more. Recognizing this, some of the great philosophies and religions of the world have denied that man can find happiness in life. Buddhism is such a religion. If you were to ask a Buddhist monk, what do you want most in life? He would answer you to be quit of life, to be free of it. To live is to suffer. Man suffers because he instinctively wants, he has appetites. So he prefers, this Buddhist monk, the beggar's bowl to the most sumptuous repast. His philosophy is to deny, to discipline himself, to rise above his natural appetites so that these no longer affect him. And then he finds peace and serenity. Gautama, the Buddha, is the great founder of this sect. In what lay his worth? He was a man of worth, of position, a learned man, a man of some political importance. But his virtue to his disciples lies not in this, but in his night of renunciation. That night in which he crept into his only son's bedchamber and kissed him silently farewell on the cheek. The night in which he embraced his sleeping wife and turned his back on son and wife and castle and position and rank and power, took up the wanderer's staff and the life of an ascetic. Only in the disciplining of our appetites, in the denying of our cravings, the Buddhist says, can happiness be found. Their noble renunciation throws our excessive and expensive pleasure seeking into a shoddy relief, does it not? Is happiness really a $6,000 car? Is happiness really a $100,000 home decorated by somebody else's professional hand? Is happiness really the key to the executive suite? But for all of its nobility, the Buddhist philosophy has an element of the selfish in it, for it is a denying of responsibility that no man can deny. The Buddha's son needed a father. The Buddha's wife needed a husband. The Buddha's kingdom needed a prince. Cities require counselors. Religions require prophets. Schools require teachers. Our bodies require physicians. We require husbands, and wives, and children, and they parents. Man is a social creature. We cannot deny the responsibilities and the affections we feel towards others. Buddhism is a way for the few. It is a noble way. A way which must give any Westerner pause for thought. But it cannot be the way of man. Is there then any happiness to be found? Happiness cannot be purchased. Happiness does not lie atop the greasy pole. Happiness cannot be found for all of us in withdrawing and escaping from life. Knowing this, many great religions and philosophies have denied that happiness is at all to be found. The great medieval church father, the mystic, Bernard of Clairvaux described life in these terms. It is misery to be born. It is a pain to live. It is a trouble to die. To classic Christianity, life is a via dolorosa, a way of sighs and of sadness. There is no happiness to be found in this earthbound existence. Life, rather, is a test, the test of our mettle, to see whether we deserve paradise or purgatory. The strict, stern, rigid morality of monasticism rests on this worldview. And there are many philosophies far less noble, far less demanding, which equally assume that there is no happiness to be found in life. Strangely, hedonism, pleasure-seeking, the philosophy which we associate with Epicurus assumes that there is no happiness in life. Life, they say, is a bitter bargain. Life is a hapless pursuit. Make the most of it. Take what you delude yourself to be happiness, gulp it down, and forget about tomorrow. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you may die. This is a simple form of careless selfishness, and many, philosophers and not, fall prey to it. It's perhaps the common philosophy of most men. It is a hapless philosophy, a wasted youth, and a burnt-out age. Is there then happiness? Our Bible assumes that there can be. Eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart. They that sow in tears shall reap in joy. A merry heart is good, good medicine. But where is happiness to be found? The Bible, strangely and significantly, offers no formula. The Bible is not a guide to positive happiness. It's a guide to good living. It's a guide to noble ethic. It's a challenge to social purpose. It's a test of character. The way to happiness is not writ large in it. But why not? Because happiness is not a thing. Happiness is not an entity, something which can be grasped and laid hold of. Happiness is a byproduct of a certain way of life. A life which we know to have meaning. A life of some nobility. A life which reaches out and stretches up to that which is worthwhile. If you follow the biblical mitzvah, the biblical commandment, you find what the rabbis call the simcha shel mitzvah, the joy, the gladness of the commandment. The joy, the gladness of being a worthwhile individual. And there you have it. Where did Abraham find happiness? When he left his father's home, an old, dissatisfying way of life, and adventured out, dared to search for a new and better way. And in that search, he found happiness. And where did Joseph find happiness? Not for all his power as minister plenipotentiary of the Pharaoh of Egypt, but at that moment when he forgave his brothers, when he overcame his natural anger and reached out for the finer element in his character. And when did Moses gain happiness? Not in the court of the Pharaoh, not when he was surrounded with all the opulence of the palace, but before the burning bush. When God gave him a mission and a mandate, a purpose for living, go back, free your people. Many of you remember the days before 1947 and 1948, when it was uncertain that any solution was possible to the establishment of a Jewish home for the displaced and the oppressed. And those of you who worked in those years for Zion know their tension. And you knew the sacrifice of time and energy in itself which was demanded of you, but there was no day, no year, no experience more glorious, happier in all of your lives. You were living for something beyond yourself, for a noble purpose. You became a finer, happier, more joyous person. We look back on those years with pride. There's an old rabbinic parable about a dog. A dog who was busy chasing himself around in circles. An older dog saw this performance and said, "Pup, what are you doing?" The young dog said, "It's not as strange as you think. I'm a philosopher, and I've studied the secrets of the universe. And I have found that there is no purpose better for a dog than that he should be happy. And I have learned that happiness is in my tail. And I am chasing my tail. And when I catch it, I shall be happy." He ran, and he ran. And finally, the old dog could stand it no more, and he said, "Pup, leave off. I too am a philosopher. I too have studied the secrets of the universe. I too know that happiness is in my tail. But I have learned that as long as I chase my tail, it runs away from me. But when I go about my business, it comes after." There you have it. When we go about our business, happiness suddenly, secretly, silently sweeps over us. There is happiness. There are joys that do come true, and there are hopes that can be realized in the living. Not by living it up, but in the living. By living up to that which is the best in us, and which we know we ought to do. Father, what is it that you want most in life? Happiness? Well, then settle down to the livelihood which is yours. Discharge your duties to your city with nobility and dignity. Encourage your family with your own strength. Be father and provider, and happiness will catch up with you. And mother, what is it that you want most in life? Happiness, you say? Well, then settle down to home and family, to these responsibilities which no one but you can undertake. Encourage with your love. Warm with your affection. Send your children and your mate out to face the world with new confidence. Be wife and mother, and happiness will catch up with you. And stranger, what is it that you want most in life? Happiness, you say? Then be skilled in your profession. Be just in your law. Be generous in your sympathy. Be dignified in your bearing. Be about your business. And happiness will catch up with you. Rabbi, you have said nothing about the white sands and the blue waters. What about the sport, the bowling and the skiing? What about the leisure hours, the parties and the dancing? Are these illicit? Not at all. Our Bible tells us the joy deferred maketh sick the heart. But the rabbis also said, why did God call the seventh day a delight? Because he worked on the first six. The moments of leisure are precious moments if they are not simply an exchange of boredom for boredom. If they come as the natural consummation of a worthwhile week, they are delight to the soul, joy to the spirit, a renewal of confidence, and worthwhile. For all of us know the simple truth. There are parties, we have been at parties in which we were unhappy. We have disported ourselves with careless abandon and found no joy. It is not the thing that we do, but the spirit that we bring to it. And that spirit comes only when we are at peace with ourselves. We celebrate the Purim. Purim is a feast of deliverance from oppression. And what do we celebrate? That those days were nehepach miyagon v'simcha, Me'evel Yom Tov, days in which God turned our destiny from sorrow into gladness, and from days of mourning into days of feast. We cannot depend upon God for our emotional deliverance. That work, that obligation begins with us and rests upon us. Happiness, my friends, is in the living. Set about it, and you will find it sweeping over you.